You're listening to
Potluck. And what is poppin', everybody? You're listening to the Good Pop Culture Club, episode 186. My name is Marvin Yue, and joining me, as always, to talk about all the good pop that gets us through our days are my co-hosts, Jess Ju, the once-in-future professional Asian-American, and Han Win, our most professional of culture editors. What's up, guys?
Hey, Marvin.
I've crossed over. I am now in my 40s.
And congratulations.
Oh my God. How's it feel?
Like, my body chose the day I turned 40 to say, you know, we're going to have a lot of problems now.
Oh, no.
What is new? Yeah. What new problems have arisen?
I like got an inexplicable fever on Saturday.
No. Okay, yeah, that's pretty bad.
Probably from just like eating too much of something. But yeah.
What joints are popping?
That's the question. They've been popping for a long time. Okay. I mean, 30s, I think, is when stuff starts popping.
Yes, if it makes you feel better, I am not in my 40s, but I like went down hard a few weeks ago, twisted both ankles, and it's still not back. I'm still hobbling around.
Twisted ankles are no joke. Gotta take care of those. Yeah.
It was terrible. It was both ankles at the same time, and it was in public, and it was like, you know, you want to like not, you know, my very internalized Asian thing of like not making it a big deal, even though I was like, it hurt really bad, but you know, I'm just like, no, fine. So you're trying to get up as quickly as possible to, you know, assure everyone you're fine. And you're like, oh God, I don't know if I'm fine.
Well, I feel that. I remember once in college, I picked up like a Radio Shack ad and I was reading it and I walked right into a pole. Mm-hmm. And then I took a moment, looked around, made sure nobody saw me and just walked around, walked off, mind my own business.
Hey, look, there was a time that I stepped into a pool at Comic-Con.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you just go walk. You're like, no, I'm fine. Here we are like 2-3 weeks later and the ankles are still stiff.
Aww.
I mean, your husband's a doctor. Did he take a look at it?
I mean, it's the diagnosis is obvious. This bitch sprained her ankle.
Yes.
She just needs to, I should technically just probably stay off of it and everything. But
the whole rice thing.
It's kind of hard. You know, you kind of need your ankle. And you've been to my place. A lot of stairs.
Yeah.
To go up and down.
Having had many sprained ankles, I do agree that like it's hard because you keep wanting to use them. And you do need to then like be careful in the future about how you step.
Yeah. Guys, we gotta take better care of ourselves.
Yeah. I'm bad at that.
We have to be able to do this podcast for decades to come, right?
Sure. I love the ambition, Marvin.
Well, speaking of ambitious, for this episode, we are taking a look at the new, very ambitious FX prestige television series, Shogun, which just dropped its fourth episode this week, so we'll be discussing up to then. But before we get to that, as always, let's find out what pop culture is picking us through this week. Jess, what's popping?
So I didn't get to spend a lot of time. I've been busy. You know, we had a family funeral over the weekend. Oh. It was, you know, very packed schedule with like just, you know, spending time with family. And then I built an IKEA couch, which was like an all night endeavor. Yay. But I did carve out time to watch the Oscars live for the first time. Mm-hmm. You know, overall, I thought it was a pretty good show. You know, Janet Yang, I'll give props where props is due. Mm-hmm. I think it's, there weren't, you know, it was very Oscars in the way that, you know, a lot of things were expected. There's one big fuck up.
Yes.
As there is every year.
Yes.
And it was pretty entertaining. I think the highlight, ironically, you know, is about a movie that won basically no awards from an actor that like everyone knew was not going to win. And of course, I'm talking about Ryan Gosling and I'm Just Ken and that big spectacle show number, which really validates my, you know, choices in pursuing theater and my love of musical theater. Like, if you enjoyed that, you enjoy musical theater. Mm-hmm. Let's bring those back. Mm-hmm. Slash not with Rob Marshall, Like, let's bring back old school, like, soundstage musical theaters again. Musical films. And, you know, of course, I did miss the part where, you know, Lily Gladstone did not win. I literally threw my phone and just walked out. Because fuck that. But, you know, the Oscars got a green book, and we'll be talking about that. Mm-hmm. And for I think, in the future. And I think, I hope there's a bigger dissection of why there has only been two women of color who have won in its 96 years. That is statistically significant in its lack of existence. I'm not a math major, but I think that is statistically significant. But overall, I thought it was like a pretty good show, and they ended early, which is insane. But oh sorry, the other person who stole the show is not a person, but the dog. Messi the dog is my new favorite meme with this little fake hands clapping.
Yes.
I think he should be. Honestly, I had this great idea. I pitched to my husband. They should remake like Wishbone, but it's Messi doing like Academy prestige TV remake, like Academy movie remakes. Like, I would watch Messi in Oppenheimer. That's the only way you'll get me to watch Oppenheimer, if he is Oppenheimer.
I caught half the show live, and I think I put this in our Slack. A lot of the bits actually hit. Like, sometimes they're like trying too hard and being not funny, but like the John Cena bit was kind of funny when he came out. Like,
they leaned into his strength.
And I really dug the Arnold Schwarzenegger Danny DeVito bit where they came out, and I thought they were gonna do twins, but they did Batman instead, and that was like even
and
funnier.
Michael Keaton was there, and it was great. You know, which just shows me, like, bring back the lowbrow pop culture phenomenon, like twins. Like, I want more twins.
I guess we can't talk about the Oscars without kind of talking about the total shutout of, like, Past Lives didn't win anything, right?
No, there was only up for two awards. It didn't win either, which was Best Picture and Original Screenplay.
And it didn't even get its chance to, like, get recognized for Best Picture.
Yeah, and so what was interesting, too, was that we did a little bit of... Salon doesn't do a lot of pre-Oscar coverage, but we did a couple interviews here and there, or a couple, like, you know, commentary pieces. And I published one about Past Lives right before, a few days before the Oscars, and that hit pretty well. And so I was just like, regardless of the win or not, I think this movie is still resonating with some people. It's also free on Canopy to stream, so that might also be part of it. It's not a pay streaming service. But yeah, I felt bad about that. But I am happy, very happy for the visual effects award for Godzilla Minus One.
Oh, that was so cute.
And they were great.
Hyped. Yeah.
Yeah. They brought their own Godzillas, including a gold Godzilla. Their heels were Godzilla hands on their heels. It was like, I was like, yes, they're having the best time ever. And you should, you know,
And then, well-deserved win, considering, like, how little money they had compared to some of these other folks. And they did a great job.
And it wasn't watched widely. It's like, it's still not, doesn't have a streaming service lined up.
No, but it is the highest grossing foreign film.
Right? Like, over Parasite. Ever. Yeah, over Parasite. So I think it's also a great film. I really enjoy it. I need people to see this. They need to re-release it in theaters, maybe, because I think the other big Japanese win of the night was an interesting story, too, which is Miyazaki got his, you know, Oscar, because, of course, people are just like, he's going to die at any moment, so let's give him another Oscar, you know. He also did not attend, kind of like when he did not attend during the Iraq war. So a lot of people are thinking that he may... because he did say something about that too. He may say something about it, about not attending this year for a reason. We shall see. But that one was not streaming. It did get announced that it will stream on Max, but as of this point, no one can watch it streaming anywhere. So
I mean, Max does have the Ghibli license. So
exactly.
That makes sense. I did love that the director of Across the Spider-Verse said, well, if you're going to lose Best Picture, you might as well lose to the GOAT.
Yes, he is very correct. He honors, he knows his elders. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So those were the small wins. Those were Asian wins, not Asian American ones. I'm fine with those two. I do wish more Asian American or diaspora stuff, you know, hit, because those are the things that
we had our year last year, you know.
Yeah, they're like just, enough sure. Asians there for needs now.
Balanced, they need balance in the force to like, you right. know, feel good about those. I mean,
what about the white people? Come on. So,
I mean technically, Emma Stone did play an Asian in one of those movies.
Yeah. Oh, they did also, like, someone I saw mentioning, which was very kind of darkly sad, was they said, oh, Oppenheimer and Godzilla Minus One winning in the same year as a movie and its sequel winning in the same year. And I was like, oh, shit. That's dark. Yes, yeah. It's dark.
And I will say, you know, like Emma Stone, I think she did a good job, great job in in Poor Things. Not like she's bad.
Right.
But it is really funny that I do think she's like the one she you could tell immediately she's like, oh, fuck.
Yes.
Like, I do not want to win this one. And
I don't need this again. Right? I don't need this in my life.
She managed to. I mean, that's why she's a movie star, too. Right. Like, Emma Stone was like very charming in how she handled that. I think it could have gone very poorly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we know that it's an Oscars problem, not a Lily Gladstone problem.
Exactly.
And I do hope that, you know, and we know that the Oscars like showier things. Right. They like.
Yeah, she did the most acting, you know, in that way, as far as like she was different from herself. And people love that. I also, no shade or hate to Emma Stone. She's
not to Emma Stone. It's to the system of the Academy and the system of the industry that, like, I think there's just a lot of anxiety from folks like us.
Yes.
Like, or people who, there's a lot of rep sweats because we know that roles are not guaranteed for women of color who win the Oscars, right?
And, like, and Emma Stone will get another chance. And in fact, she already has another Yorgos Lanthimos, you know, leading role lined up. So they definitely could have waited and just been like, given her like a sympathy, you know, not that she needs it. You know, she's done enough. She's gotten enough awards. So the one thing is, I will say about her, like you were saying, you could tell on her face that she was kind of like, oh, no.
Fuck.
She's one of the few people who's actually said something about like playing Asian in Aloha or whatever that movie was. So where she was like, I'm sorry. You know, so like she kind of understands like the optics of things, too. So, that was a sort of a hard pill to swallow.
But. And I'm going to be real. They were not going to give.
They weren't going to do it. Yeah.
I also think there's just going to be a part of like this very, you know, this industry, which is like very risk adverse to. They totally shit out Flowers of the Killer Moon, which, you know, is a movie about American genocide.
Yep. And they raise up Oppenheimer, which is a movie that created a weapon, you know, about creating a weapon that can, you know, cause genocide.
Enable.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So that's like in a nice white man way that they can handle.
Right.
And
I mean,
not
Hollywood
in the,
loves
like,
a great man movie, right?
Oh, great white man. Like, oh my God. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yes.
And again, no shade to Cillian Murphy, who I adore as an actor. So, and as a person, I like him as a person.
Too. Shade to Christopher Nolan, though, man. Learn how to write a woman.
Absolutely. See, it's all the old white man filmmakers that I have issues with, too.
I also don't understand because I was like, Emma, your wife slash producing partner seems to have like probably has like a lot of say and control in your process as well. Because very famously, apparently Christopher Nolan does not have a phone. So apparently like this poor woman has to do like all the texting fucking communication for him. So yeah, she fucking deserves that Oscar, you know, as a producer, if you're going to make her go through all of that. But I was like, I mean, you have a women. You know people, like, why can't you write it?
I mean, some people are just stuck in their creative ways, right? That's why writing rooms exist for TV. But, you know, film is about the auteur. Film is about the unfiltered voice of one person who has something to say.
One person and the thousands of people who helped make the movie.
Yes. I did find it significant that the editor who won for Oppenheimer is a woman. So,
yeah.
Good for her.
She had a good speech, too. A lot of great speeches.
Yeah, she did. Yeah. There were really some great moments and some good speeches. So, yeah, it was overall entertaining. I think the Emmys was entertaining, though no one watched it. And then this one was also sort of lowly viewed also, which
is sad. It did end super awkward, though, with Al Pacino. It wasn't a La La Land moment, but it was kind of close.
Okay, well, in like, if like La La Land is, you know, top tier, I'd say like just below that is like the Chadwick Boseman, Anthony Hopkins winning and him not even being there.
Yes.
Like where is this?
Not,
I mean,
not,
the Al Pacino thing's not a big deal in the big grand scheme.
It was just
things.
Awkward. Yeah, that's all.
All right. Yeah, Oscars. It happened. Now we get to
now we go dormant until we get to complain about next year's.
Yeah. Well, we have the Emmys in this coming up in a few months.
And more importantly, next week Top Chef comes back. So
yes. Yeah. Yeah. Go Asian returns.
Yeah, set in the heartland here. We'll see.
All right. Besides the Oscars, Han, what's popping with you?
I was actually going to offer this to Jess because I was like, I bet you this would be Jess's.
It's like, how can we get more deranged on this one episode of a podcast?
Yeah, but then I was like, you know what? She can just join me. So basically what I'm going to bring up is some gossip. I don't know if you've heard. I don't know if you've been following this, Marvin, but something's going on with Kate Middleton.
I mean, it's everywhere, so I kind of...
You heard a little bit.
Idea of that something's up and that there's a doctored photo somewhere. And that's, I haven't dug deep because I don't really care.
I'm going to speed through the timeline of this. But basically, early in January, we heard that she was going to be getting abdominal surgery. This was the same time we heard that King Charles was going to go and get some sort of like test going on. He got tests. He has some sort of cancer. They didn't specify what, but that he's getting treatment. He's still doing his duties. However, she was not seen before that announcement, but she hasn't been seen since. The announcement also said that we wouldn't see her until like Easter. Maybe they just thought like if we give them like 4 months to not think about her, people aren't going to care, right? That's wrong. So there's been so many weird things that have happened. A lot of it's broken down online, so I won't go into that because honestly, that would take a whole podcast episode, I believe, or more. But as you were saying, the most recent stuff is that on Mother's Day in the UK, there was a picture released of her and her three kids looking very happy, very clearly fake photo. Like, as soon as it even came out, I was just like, no one has to tell me this is Photoshop. Like, this is wrong, a wrong photo. Because also, like, all the communications from the palace have not been very forthcoming. Of course, there have been conspiracy theories out the wazoo. And Jess and I can talk a little bit about those, about her absence and what may have caused it. But the thing is, the big deal about the doctored photo is that it's probably one of the first really solid pieces of evidence that the palace is trying to sell us something, like a lie.
No.
Previous
that happens.
Yeah. Previous statements could have been almost been like, whatever. But then, and every attempt since to cover up has just been horrible. And now
so
it's just
bad.
Like, no, it's like they had a statement from where it's like they're like, oh, I did some like light photo editing. I occasionally do that. And I was like, first of all, you didn't do that.
Everyone's like, you do not have a subscription to Adobe.
Yes,
Princess
exactly.
Kate.
Yeah. And then there was a second photo that's supposedly a candid of the back of her head or something in the car. There was a previous photo even supposedly where she was in the car with her mother that caused a little bit of suspicion, but they're like, whatever, it's a pat photo, who knows? But yeah, it was the official photo when they released it that really caused the furor. So Jess, I want to know, what are some of your favorite conspiracy theories that you've heard about?
Oh, my favorite is that she's competing on The Masked Singer. You know, that's like a very low stakes, fun one. You know, there's theories, Marvin, that she got a BBL and is now recovering.
Do you know what a BBL is?
Brazilian butt lift.
Yes.
It takes time. Recovery time, baby. Actually, it's more like 2-3 months recovery time.
Sure.
And then some of them get a little darker, but I also wouldn't be surprised if that was the case, you know, that this is like a this is like a test drive of like the impending divorce,
mm-hmm.
or even something more serious that, like, you know, there's like scandal, which, you know, I love drama that's not mine and doesn't mm-hmm. affect my real life. So, you know, there's things that she's like doing this as a power play because William has been, you know, stepping out on her and in an embarrassing way. Because, oh, I don't know what Han neglected to mention is also on Mother's Day, the one of these British tabloids that is typically in the pocket, you know, mm-hmm. is in the Royal Rota and works closely with the palace, published this like weird article about who is the Marchioness of Cholmondeley, which you will mm-hmm. never be able to spell because there's yes. no way that
that word too many letters
pronounces Cholmondeley.
Yeah.
But essentially like his alleged mistress, who was also like their friend when they lived in Norfolk. And it's like, why are you choosing today of Mother's Day yes. to publish this? Like, is this a threat from the press? Is this like a soft launch of his Camilla? Because, mm-hmm. you know, they've done research and you are more likely to commit infidelity if your parents committed infidelity mm-hmm. or you mm-hmm. come from a household that like was affected by infidelity. And like, you know, like the image is crumbling, right? The image has crumbled. We know how mm-hmm. bad Will can get. Mm-hmm. with all we learned in Spare and basically how much the palace will go to protect the image of mm-hmm. the royal family. And now we're all smart to it, and we're American, so we don't give a fuck.
Yes.
So like we have like Andy Cohen and John Oliver talking about it on Watch What's Happening. Like that's just
yes,
that's just so delightful. You know, it's delightful as long as she's actually okay, you know, like physically. And you know, we get to like kind of have fun with this. But yeah, we'll see. Only time will tell.
Yeah, it's gotten pretty dark. But there's a Slack group I'm a part of that the thread got so out of hand that we just created a whole channel for this. And it's a very private channel. So where we can talk about all the very bad theories we have.
I did have to explain to my husband, who like was also on the periphery, and I was like, I feel like that picture of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where I'm like explaining the entire oh, yes. like conspiracy board. But this is a fun conspiracy, yes, right? Yes, like this is the most fun we've had since like the yeah. submarine. Like, let's be real.
Yeah, the darkest I got is that she is not to say this, but you know, she's actually dead.
Were Weekend at Bernie-ing her?
Yeah, weekends at Bernie's, and then and that since they said that she will come back for Easter, I was like, oh, so like Christ, and so they're gonna like there's gonna be a whole she has risen sort of situation. So yeah, so I was just like, I had to apologize to my friends for that one because I was just like, I'm sorry, I'm a heathen. But yeah, so it's just, I think for me, I agree. The thing is, I really literally don't care about this woman. That's why I guess I can joke about her being dead. I don't actually wish ill on her, but at the same time, I kind of don't care. But I think for me, as someone who has been in entertainment and stuff like that, the absolute horrible PR is what fascinates me. Like, yeah. How bad can they be? And then
how
they keep digging their holes.
So can they get?
Obviously, yeah. Like, obviously they know that they're going up against the modern internet, who are
now,
when the internet hyperfixates on a thing, they hyperfixate, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And I mean, these people are supposed to be the wealthiest landowners in all of England. Mm-hmm. They have like
yeah.
unfathomable riches and resources, right? Do you think they could have hired a better graphic artist to help doctor their photos?
It's two things. One is they're old, right? And then two is they're powerful. So they, in their hubris, would never think that anyone would doubt them. And so I think the last thing they did, I think they're going to just go like maybe low tech now and just release statements and stuff if they do anything at all. Because I think they realized, oh, we shouldn't be touching the photos anymore. So, but we'll see. We'll see. I feel like the reporters in England are like climbing walls and tapping phones, and if they haven't already done, you know, but they're going out of their way now. So whatever leaks from that end to us is where we're going to find out. But yeah, I'm just, it's kind of like when a horrible abuser releases a statement here in America and you're just like, that wasn't an apology. And in fact, it makes you sound worse. That kind of bad PR where I'm just like, you just dug a hole because honestly, I didn't care. But the fact that you're covering it up this badly means that I think there's something going on now. And that alerted everybody. So,
but at the same time, is this important? Do we care? Right? Do we?
No, but that's why it's fun because it does not matter. Yeah,
it doesn't affect us at all. Right. It's actually the lighter thing, one of the lighter things that's happening in the world right now. And that's why we're allowed to have fun with it. So,
yeah.
Anyway, sorry. You now know a little bit of what's going on, Marvin. So, what is popping with you?
I have been cursed with knowledge. All right, I'm going to keep this brief since we spent so much time talking about the Royals and the Oscars. But what's popping for me has been Unicorn Overlord, which was the video game that I talked about a couple of weeks ago. It officially released last Friday. And man, I just can't stop playing it. It is a tactical RPG that combines the gameplay concepts of Fire Emblem with Tactics Ogre. And if you're into tactical RPGs, that is like a perfect combination. Essentially, you're controlling units of up to 5 characters of different classes against other units across a battlefield. You essentially assign your marching orders in real time, and then the battles play out automatically in turn-based fashion according to pre-assigned orders that you give to the units. So that's kind of where the hooks of this game has gotten into me, because for each character you can assign individual orders through kind of like computer programming, like if and statements, like, okay, if there is this type of unit on the battlefield, you use this skill to counter that. So it's a lot of like, you can play it without going that deep, but for me, like as someone who like loves this shit, it's been a lot of fun. I am running into some, like, it is a Japanese RPG and it takes a lot of cues from like Japanese design aesthetics, which means a lot of big boob ladies and stuff. And so at first it was fine in like the human nations because like everyone's kind of dressed up in armor, but then you get to the elf nation and these elves are kind of wearing like battle bikinis. And then I just reached the Beastmen nation, and man,
oh no,
these are some sexy furries they have in
no!
here.
You know, that is always probably my biggest issue when it comes to my love and hate of Japanese media, because there is something really cool about how weird it can be, but then they do that, and I'm just like, can we not evolve just a little bit? But yeah, I'm very happy for you when it comes to the tactical coding or whatever.
It's I put in like at least like 20 hours of the weekend, which is like way too much time. My wife has been like,
it's okay, I understand. I've been the PS5 widow for like the last weekend. It's fine, you know, it's fine.
So yeah, Unicorn Overlord, I've been playing on my Switch, which means not only can I play on my TV, I can also play when I'm supposed to be sleeping in bed, which
is, I'm sure your wife loves that.
But it's also available on PlayStation. I don't think it's on PC yet, but I think it might be on Xbox. But yeah, it's great. Check it out. I guess with that, we're gonna take a quick break and talk about an Englishman who's not a royal.
Nice.
We are discussing FX's new prestige television series Shogun. When we come back, so stick around.
Hey, I'm Bill Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation.
The good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallusbruce.com.
Peace.
Hey, Brian. Did you go to Saturday school as a kid?
I sure did. Did you?
Totally.
Well, at our podcast, Saturday School, we don't teach a language, but we pass along the culture that we do know.
And that's Asian American pop culture.
Ada's a journalist, and I'm a professor and film festival programmer.
We've watched a lot of great Asian American movies, and we want you to watch them too. Come listen to us as we look back at the pioneering films that have led us to today.
And welcome back to the Good Pop Culture Club. On this episode, we are discussing Shogun, the new FX prestige historical drama limited series created by Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks, based on the 1975 novel of the same name by James Clavell, which was already previously adapted into a television miniseries in 1980. The show follows English sailor John Blackthorne, played by Cosmo Jarvis, as he gets shipwrecked in Japan and finds himself the hostage/ward of Lord Toranaga, played by Hiroyuki Sanada, as the stirrings of civil war starts to ferment following a power struggle that starts after the death of the ruling shogun. So the story so far has followed these two men, John's struggle to survive in this new world as a rough-talking Englishman, and Lord Toranaga as he shrewdly navigates court politics as he prepares for an inevitable military conflict. And tying them together is Lady Mariko, played by Anna Sawai, who acts as John's translator and Toranaga's trusted vassal. The characters and story are loosely based on the real-life historical Sengoku period, which was the Warring States period that saw the rise of the Tokugawa shogunate, in which Toranaga's faction is modeled after, as well as the journey of real-life English navigator William Adams, who John Blackthorne's character is based on as well. So, yeah, four episodes in, what do we think of the 2024 version of Shogun?
You know what? So many people said it was good before it came out. People I trust. And I was just like, I don't know. I did feel very reluctant. It is good, though, because they gave all of their efforts into the prestige TV like production side, but also on the storytelling side. Do I have some quibbles? Yes, we will get to those. But overall, it's good TV. And they really give a lot of like effort to the Japanese storytelling aspect of it, down to, you know, the movements and the correct, you know, gestures. But I just feel like you can feel all the actors being really like, oh my God, this is our time to shine. And so, you know, you do see the white guy as the main guy, but like he's just there. It's fine. Like he is the, you know, point of view character, I guess, for most of the audience here in America. But you know what? He's not the one who shines. So I'm kind of okay with it. I haven't finished it, but so far so good. I think I'm going to tell my mom to watch. So
oh wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when we first discussed the trailer for this show on a previous Do We Want This? Mm-hmm. And kind of feeling like it looks good, but the premise is very sketch, like very questionable. And I was happy to see that they kind of pulled they kind of did a Marco Polo, right, where the white guy point of view character is kind of a side character in all things considered to the historical political drama that's playing out in the story.
Yeah, he's definitely a tool. And you can see how much like money they threw at this in a good way. Like the costumes, fantastic. The sets, you know, the ones, I understand it's TV, so we're going to, you know, we're talking about like historical stuff. So we're going to get some like CGI, but, you know, like, you know, they're riding horses, they're carrying banners, there's like real gates and courtyards and palaces that they've constructed. It even has that like prestige TV problem where everything's too fucking dark. So if you're watching this on a daytime, you know, the week of daylight savings where the sun doesn't go down, you're like, what the fuck am I watching sometimes? And you've been to my house, it's very bright. Like I have a lot of windows in my like main living room area. So yeah, like I can't fault any of that. They definitely kind of put their money where their mouth is. It could have gone much worse, again, considering the source material. I will say it is like, it seems to actually be more based on like some historical points of like Japanese history and the Civil War than the, you know, novel series written by this white guy.
Yes.
I mean, it seems like the novel itself focused way more on Blackthorne's journey and point of view. And so I really like that. Maybe it's because there is an Asian woman helming the project, but it's very rightfully focusing more on like what is the real drama, which is this power struggle, which, you know, in Japanese media is kind of like, it's the Japanese version of the War of the Roses, right? It's the type of, it's the story that's been done over and over again, because this is the most like compelling like example of feudal succession wars in Japanese history. It's like Three Kingdoms era in Chinese media, right?
Yeah. I, you know, it's, look, when FX first announced this was several years ago, and it was even before the trailer, I definitely had a lot of concerns. At the time, there was one Japanese name associated with it, and it was way down on the list. And I think I even wrote about it, like, what the fuck is going on? Come on, FX, you got to do better. And, you know, it's not that they necessarily listened to me. I think they knew which way the wind was blowing, that they had to do so. But FX has also been good about correcting things in the past anyway. So when it comes to production, so like they've definitely made an initiative to hire more women and queer people and marginalized people as directors. And creative. So, you know, it kind of made sense that they were going to, like, sort of write a few things when it came to this narrative. James Clavell's daughter, I believe, is still an executive producer on this. So, you know, that's nice of them to let her granddaughter, I can't remember exactly what, Mykella. So that was fine. But yeah, you can definitely tell that they really did. Like, so much. And kind of to the point, like, sadly, I think there are going to be certain things that stick to the novel, which you can't get away from. But I also do want to hopefully look at it as a function of the period of time. Because, yeah, women did not get a lot of great stuff happening to them. But you do see in a few of these plot lines, and we can talk about this a little bit more deeply, is the way that they wield their power from their positions, though, still. So yeah, it gave me some stuff to think about, but it was also very entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot of discourse online saying, oh, this is like Japanese Game of Thrones, which I hate that that's like the point of reference for most people, but sure. I think they Game of Thrones is probably the first exposure to like political drama for a lot of people in the general public.
This is so much more. This is not a fantasy world, though. Mm-hmm. This is like very, which is what surprised me. Like part of me from like from my critical perspective, like it, I have less problems with this from a representative point and more like personal like questions or like critiques, I guess, on it's like how dense some of the material is for how short a run they're doing. Because I think I had to Google this, right? Because I'm just mm-hmm. like, I want to make sure I'm getting my, like, mm-hmm. you know, I want to know the names. I want to figure out some of these actors. I stumble upon, like, the website from FX. And they have full-ass history lessons mm-hmm. on mm-hmm. their page, which is, like, both very cool and awesome. Like, I don't think you have room to put this in your show. And if this is necessary to understanding the full extent of your show, like, I don't know if that's a good adaptation choice.
They did have that one character who acted as the expository guy to
the guy in the jail.
The jail priest to lay out the relationship between.
But there's a lot of things. I think culturally, I think I see where the show is trying to explain mm-hmm. some of the cultural differences of like how, you know, the Japanese culture and the warrior class specifically see like life and death, how they see honor, how they see their values, or like what it means to serve the Lord, right? Or like, oh, like, oh, he's a prisoner in this castle, but, you know, no one's like physically barring him. It's all like this very like understated thing. Like some people can leave and some people, there's just like a lot of like, there's a culture layer and then there's the historical layer you have to explain. And I do think in having to explain all that, we miss some of the, maybe that's like room that like, we could have used more for emotional beats. And I think that's just also a symptom of like the audience and that this is an American television. So you do have to explain some of these things. Like, I don't think we have to explain like Western values and culture, like in Game of Thrones, you know, we hate that example, but like in Game of Thrones, we don't have to explain why, like, mm-hmm. oh, like he has to marry well because that's his job as captain. Or like right. this family, like looks out for each other. This is how this family looks out for each other. But I do think, like, if we're trying to center, like, the Japanese perspective, at least, or, like, make us care about the Japanese perspective, but your audience is Western. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, oh, like, I don't know if the show spent enough time in the first few episodes, like, making me understand why I should care for these people or why I should root for one person over the other. Like, I'm getting told a lot of things, like, Toranaga's a wise ruler. I'm like, yeah, and Hiroyuki Sanada does a lot to sell that. He's great. I'm like, okay, I'm told to care about like this family, but not that family. I'm like, oh, why? I'm told, should I care about like this?
Well, I think at this point it's more, you want to root for the people you spent the most time with, but there's obviously like, we're dealing with like a noble class where everything is can't be taken at face value, right?
Yeah,
like, and that's kind of fun, kind of exploring those relationships as well. Like all the platitudes, right?
Yeah, I do think that they do set it up several times. Not everyone not only cannot be trusted, but I agree that that includes Toranaga as far as what are his actual intentions, because he's not a warm dad, you know, or husband or any of those things.
To be fair, he kind of has a failed son, though.
Look, poor guy. How can you be his son and actually live up to that? His son is a very big fail son, though.
This story, much like all stories about great men and heroes,
is that the greatness is not legacy. Genetics.
And you know what? Hiroyuki Sanada he's gonna always be cool. So
he's so cool.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, that's why probably, you know, the built-in reason why you kind of root for him. But honestly, you don't. So for me, I'm just kind of like enjoying the politics of everything. Probably the people I feel for the most are the ones who have the least power. As I was talking about the women, I'm sorry, I don't know the names, but the woman.
Fuji.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. That poor fucking woman. Okay. Yes. Like I'm not going to lie. That first episode was rough. I almost bounced because I was like, I don't even like kids, but you are going to do that to this poor woman?
That's
like,
what happens when you marry a fail son.
Yeah, that he is so bad. This was also, I seem to remember something like this when I was younger, because I am old enough to have watched the original Shogun, which is why I was thinking about recommending this to my mom, because she definitely watched it. She watched anything with Richard Chamberlain.
Know. There's infant death and horse death. But that might be a little much.
No, my mom's okay with death. It's just sex that she doesn't like. So I think for me, I remember being introduced to seppuku pretty early on when I was a kid. And I think that's something that maybe people haven't been reminded of it in quite a while. So there's been a lot of talk about the violence in this show. And so I am curious, what do you think about the violence in the show?
I think it's very deliberate, and I you know, like, they're very smart with their camera shots, right? Like, it's violent to show it's violent, but I think it doesn't necessarily cross the line in a weird way. But like, again, for me, like, it was rough because it's just like, there's not much humor or levity in this show.
There's some.
I mean, all the humor and levity comes from one person. We can talk about that later.
Yes, we'll bring that up.
The Spanish dude. But like in the Japanese nobility world, it's like very straight laced. It's very strict. It's very, you know, controlled, and it's just not a fun time. It's not a fun world to be in. And I think that's just more of a, like, a personal opinion of, like, I'm like, again, like, I didn't necessarily after a long day of work want to, like, turn on and, like, you know, watch a fucking baby get murked.
Yeah.
You know, we don't see it on screen, but it is very heartbreaking.
It's horrible.
Yeah. It's so horrible, right? Like, they fucking pick the cutest baby too, and they let you, like, see it, like, multiple, you know, like the squirmy little tubby baby. So, like, it's pretty brutal because they're trying to show that this world is brutal. But yeah, like, it the brutality does not make it like a fun way to spend your time. But it's like, it makes sense to the world they're creating and, you know, the genre they're doing. But, like, I personally, like, you know, they handle it well, but I don't enjoy necessarily it so much. But, like, we don't, you know, a lot of deaths you don't see on screen.
I don't think this is a show that we should have binged in order to catch up in time for the podcast. That's not how it's meant to be watched. That is. So FX did think about the heaviness of the show, and it's being released weekly, except for the beginning, which were two episodes. So I do agree. It is pretty heavy. The few moments of levity are in the insults that are traded between the Englishman and the Spaniard who
he's a hoot.
They're you know, they
the
are
Spanish guys a hoot.
They are a medieval type of insults, so they have to get pretty creative. So I do enjoy that. But I also feel like we might have seen the last of these two buddies. So
and I will say, I will give credit for credit where credit is due. This show, maybe because of like there are they look like there's women in the credits, you know what I'm saying? They are able to effectively communicate how shitty it is to be a woman in this world and the lack of authority and autonomy they have in this patriarchy without resorting to on-screen sexual violence.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Which is like, thank you. Like you get, and they still have their moments of where they, you know, contribute and they're powerful, but it's like, mm-hmm. and you know, the people around them acknowledge that they're like, mm-hmm. smart and like they're smarter than the men in the room, but you know, the world we're in, what can you do? You know, so I'm like, see, Game of Thrones, you can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, this being prestige TV, you have to have booby sex scenes, but they've been mostly consensual and, might I say, at least portrayed tastefully.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I think most of the nudity that is maybe not quite as tasteful is just nude men. I think
a lot of hairy chests, or one hairy chest in particular.
If this is prestige TV and it requires violence and sexuality or sex, then you know, I think that they downplay the sex, which is as they should, because this we do not need to exoticize Asians, even if it is the 1600s. And that's what sold it, I think, back in the day for the original miniseries. But so I'm very glad that they definitely have flipped it as far as how they approach the scenes. They're tasteful. I mean, you know what? They still want to show intimacy. That's important. They still want to show someone using her sexuality very smartly. They did that. So far, I'm good with that. Now, are some of the women going to still get the wrong end of the stick? Sure, probably.
Oh, 100%.
But at least, hopefully, not in a sexual way. So,
Yeah. I mean, we are in the 1600s. This is the age of exploration, post-Renaissance. The European powers are starting to build their empires. And we were talking about levity. And personally, for me, one of the main sources of levity is our point of view character, John Blackthorne, played by Cosmo Jarvis, who is just doing his best, like channeling. A lot of people say he's like channeling Tom Hardy in his like portrayal of this
some
guy.
Of his line readings are wild. I'm like, you are in a different show, which I don't know if that's deliberate. Like, can I do my best, John Blackthorne?
Yes, please.
Right now, where am I then? Where are my men? You promised me that. You promised me my ship. Where are my men? That's my best job, Blackthorne.
I do love that he's kind of portrayed as like a, like, you know, usually these like fish out of water, it's always like some English gentleman coming and like bringing civilization to the new world. Here he's just kind of, he's just a dude. He's just kind of an idiot, right? Just yelling insults, being all like, in their words, kind of barbaric. And I do love that, like, both sides are keep calling each other barbarians because they don't, like...
Well, John Blackthorne doesn't bathe, so...
That was... I actually laughed out
loud. That was great.
At that scene where the Englishman refuses to bathe because he already bathed this week. And I'm like, man...
He's like, twice a week? What?
Because I think in the Middle Ages, when it came to Europe, or at least England, the thought was that you were, you know, washing off things that were keeping you protected. So that was actually bad.
To be fair, they got their water from also where they shit. So the water was bad. Foul, yes. You know.
Yeah, that was their own doing though. Yes.
I didn't watch that really bad Persuasion, but he was the guy from that, right?
Yes, I watched the very bad Persuasion though.
Oh, the very bad Persuasion was very fun to watch.
Yes,
it was a very silly watch.
We went in knowing that it wasn't the best Persuasion. Persuasion,
but he wasn't so big in
he was
that
fine.
Persuasion, right? Like he seems buffer here.
Well, he knew he was going to be naked a lot, right? Like Jane Austen versus Shogun. Yeah, he was going to be showing a lot more skin here and diving into the water and getting whipped and, you know, all this other stuff. So he buffed up a little bit. Persuasion was fine. I had some fun moments and I hated it because the biggest scene for me in Persuasion, I think they fucked up. But here he's perfectly good. Besides being buff, he is, you know, shown in his 5'10" glory, which, you know, he gets to be seen as very tall here, which, you know, I consider tall, but I think most Americans will think that that's kind of short. So I was like, good for him.
Like every episode he has new just amazing insults, like we said, like milk dribbling, F smear, like he's just constantly just cursing at everyone around him, but no one can understand him, so it's fine.
There were some moments where I'm like, I felt very much like the Japanese guys who are like, don't care about your Christian nonsense. I'm like, yeah, dude, like the Catholic Protestant thing, I'm like, I don't really care. Like, let's keep it moving. Let's get to a little more fighting, a little more action, a little less talky. But yeah, they went full prestige on that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the central conflicts here for John Blackthorne is he is on a mission from the crown to like find the Japans, as they call it.
The Japans, yes.
The Japan. He said it in a weird way, like the Japans.
The Japans. Yeah, or
Japans.
The Japans. And because like Portugal has had sole contact with Japan for like decades at this point, all the conversations between John and everyone else is ostensibly in Portuguese. Mm-hmm. And so it took me a while to like realize that they were like doing the Hunt for Red October thing where they're portraying English as Portuguese. Like, how long did it take you guys to like clue in on that?
Someone mentioned that to me before I started watching. So that that was like no issue for me. But yes, you're right. It's kind of like, oh, I'm here to practice my Portuguese. And I'm waiting, you know, you would wait and wait. And you're like, oh, wait, that is Portuguese in this show. It's English that we're hearing, though.
I picked up on it pretty quickly, but I've read a lot of scripts with this like convention. And I honestly was like, man, y'all should have committed and made everyone learn Portuguese too, bitch.
Yep, I would have enjoyed that.
You make all these people have to speak Japanese. Make them, you know, shoes on the other foot, white boy. You got to have a second language on hand, too.
Yeah, that would have been interesting with casting also. They might have been able to find someone who is Portuguese. I also like the fact, because this totally went over my head when I was a kid, is the fact that this is a, you know, colonialism story with the Portuguese, because usually I'm thinking of either the English, the Spanish, or in my country's case, the French, when I think about the white Europeans. And so, like, Portuguese, I was like, oh, interesting. Yes, yes, that makes sense. And that how that there's like this war with England over trying to take over Japan. Japan's like, no, hello.
And we don't want to be taken over by either of you. Yeah.
And the fact that their plan is just regime change, which, like, of course, that's like the white world's most favorite tactic in colonization is regime change. Right?
And religion. But yeah. I think there are several like interesting political moves that have been happening that I'm just like, oh, that's fun to watch. But also, when, you know, it's being telegraphed very clearly what this one, you know, fail son is doing, and then how he's manipulating another one.
That scene when the two fail sons were talking, I was like, oh no. The fail sons are talking to each other.
Yeah. And I was like, well, we'll see which one is the bigger fail son. It's the one who's being manipulated. And so I was just like, oh shit. And also in the worst way, like, I don't think we're going to necessarily spoil it that much. But at the same time, I was just like, I don't remember this from the original series. I don't remember much at all from the original series, apparently. But at the same time, I was like, God, this kid is going to die. He's so worth, you know, he's going to die at some point, or he needs to for the show. So, I'm kind of braced for the panorama of death that is going to be coming in the second half of the series.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I say? You want to say to the fail sons, though? Be a better dad. Yep. Teach your kids better. That's on you, bitch.
Wait, be warm and caring when you're trying to like get a shogunate? Yeah, there's some weird stuff going on. I think the person I feel, besides the women, who I feel the worst for is that one grandpa, because he lost a son and a grandson.
He's probably a bad dad, too, though, to be honest. Like, I don't think any of these people are good dads.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Like, have we seen a good dad? John Blackthorne isn't.
No.
They all suck.
Yeah.
One of my other favorite characters, though, is Yabushige, provincial
great.
Lord.
He's an outright, like,
skis.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to call him a villain, but he's an outright person who is not loyal. And so
trying to survive. And
right.
What I love most about him is, like, I feel like they picked the most Sean Bean-looking Asian man to play this guy. So I kept thinking he was going to die in the first episode, but
he survived. He keeps existing. And he actually makes me laugh. Maybe unintentionally. Yeah. But yeah, he's
a really well, interestingly written character. Mm-hmm. My only issue is, again, like that first episode, like, I do think they set up some of, again, and I'm like, I'm seeing this perspective of, like, you're introducing, like, a historical context of these, like, other people who are not white, mm-hmm. To a Western audience. And, like, the Japanese are pretty, like, to use their own terms, they are pretty fucking barbaric in that first scene, mm-hmm. in those first episodes, which is not to say that, you know, like, it's not, you know, you shouldn't be to a bunch of, like, crazy white people who, like, come up to your land with ill intentions. But again, like, I mean, boiling someone alive just to, like, maybe get some enlightenments, like, that did seem like a little maybe
that
past
feels
the
like
edge
something
of, like, normal, like a normal villain to, like, oh, you're like a, like, that's a little, like, Fu Manchu-y to me.
That feels like a holdover from the novel. Like, I want to say that sounds like something that, like, they kept in from the novel, because it did feel,
like,
out of
I'm
place,
like,
right?
You're already, like, beheading villagers, like, willy-nilly, and because, you know, like, fiefdom sucks and, like, being a peasant sucks. But, like, yeah, so there were some choices, I think, when they were trying to, like, make, like, a punch in that first episode. I was like, maybe punching a little too hard. Again, the white people already think we're, like, we eat dogs and shit. Like, maybe, like, scale it back.
And also, it feels different from the character that we see later. Like,
yeah, right. He's just kind of a greedy, swarmy, non-loyal, like, wants to, like, come out on top. I don't know if he's, like, has philosophical questions about, like, what it means to die. Like,
yeah, and that he, you know, relishes that, like, just feeling something, even it means, like, people have to die for him to feel something. Like, that just seemed super dark and twisted to me. And that's not what I get from this character from the rest of the series. So, yeah, it was very odd because I had to disconnect from that, because I was like, wow, like, they were right, they were going dark, and then later on it got a little bit slightly lighter, and I was like, huh.
Yeah,
okay.
I feel like that's something that we're gonna have to run into throughout the rest of the run of this series, is the tension between this historical drama they want to tell, this fictional retelling of, like, one of the great civil wars of Japanese history, and what this dude wrote in, like, the 80s mm-hmm. about his
white,
like,
dude, yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. About his Japanese power fetish, right?
Right. I mean, I don't know anything about James Clavell besides the fact that I've watched two of his books become miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. But but, like, did he do any research besides historical? Did he visit Japan? Did he do anything? And I don't think he did. So I don't know. I could be wrong.
Okay, strike one. I'm Wikipediaing him right now. Strike one. He's Australian. All criminals and perverts.
Okay. Okay.
He fought the Japanese in World War II.
Great. Great.
So that's strike two.
Yes.
He was captured in Java, Indonesia, sent to a Japanese prisoner of war camp, and then transferred to Changi prison in Singapore. So
he didn't necessarily research them with the best intentions.
Or you know, he's obviously colored by his experience.
Right, exactly. So we're lucky to have gotten even the novel we did from him.
I mean, at the very least, for the show, they did update the names so they actually are Japanese names and not, like, what was that show we watched before with the fake Japanese names?
Avatar?
Yeah.
Roku? anyway. Yeah. So I think there's been a lot to correct that they did correct here. It's still going to be tragic, as as it's expected. You know, they got to stay true enough there. It's also the Middle Ages, so it's kind of like, what do you expect?
It's not the Middle Ages, though. This is like...
Not the Middle Ages. Okay,
1600s.
1600s. So, but it's still pretty far back.
There's guns, during, man.
People are dying. It's still brutal. You know, they get hurt. So, like, I'm not expecting this to have a happy ending, so...
I mean, not for the characters, but we... Based on history, we do know who comes out on top. Because the Tokugawa shogunate is the ruling...
It's like, called
regime until the Meiji Restoration, which led to Imperial Japan.
Yeah, it's called Shogun for a reason. and history, you know, holds up this character as one of the big, quote unquote, peacemakers, even though he's still a military sort of like leader.
Peacemaker, maybe a little far. Unifiers, right?
The great. Well, look, peacemakers are also people who kill a lot of people. So, you know, because there's peace there. But yeah, exactly. So it's kind of like, I think we're very okay to side-eye anything that we see here, including, you know, who you decide to make a hero from history. But yeah, I think all the people are going to be losing in some way that I remotely think, feel for. And just, I'm not getting too attached to them, so...
Yeah, I mean, as long as the, I love that two of the rival regents are the Christian lords. I'm like, I just want them to lose automatically.
I will say I do enjoy leprosy Christian lord who is like sequestered, who's fucking like, they make him sit behind a curtain and like I'll be all veiled because he has leprosy, aka Hansen's disease. And he just like pops in. He's like, hey, and then he goes back into his little curtain. Yeah. Like, closet.
I don't know if that was in the original novel or not, but I do have to say that they made it very easy for me to at least understand who a few of these people are separately from each other. So thank you for adding leprosy character.
Whoever. Yeah. And I love that the two Christian lords are like two different versions of how someone would turn to Christianity as someone in power. One is to find salvation in the face of mortality, and one is pure greed, which,
That tracks. Absolutely.
All right. Well, Shogun is currently still playing. The fourth episode came out earlier this week. And I think there's 10 episodes in total. But final verdict, is the 2024 version of Shogun good pop? And will you keep watching?
Yes, I reluctantly say yes, because of course I wish this was an original Asian American story, not based on some white guy colonizer's story. However, I think they've done a great job with it, and it is entertaining no matter what. Yes, I will tell my mom to watch.
A tentative yes from me. It's more just not my cup of tea in terms of the kind of the brutality and the seriousness and the runtime. They're like hour long episodes. I enjoy the fact that they're trying to make this a more nuanced drama with like real characters. I appreciate the fact that they're getting more like writers of Japanese descent in the room. But, you know, after reading the process of how they write the Japanese script, which I don't know if you've heard, they apparently like do multiple rounds of translation. Like they write it in English, they send it to a Japanese translator. That Japanese translator then sends it to a Japanese playwright who does not speak English at all. They do a pass on that, and then they translate it back into English so the writers know what's happening. And I'm like, that's a lot of money that I kind of still wish was being invested in stories and even actors. Okay, I mean, like, I don't want to sound bitter, but like actors in the diaspora, because we still do have a disadvantage because, you know, how many of us are not bilingual? Anna Sawai is from New Zealand as well. She does do American things. And, you know, obviously Hiroyuki Sanada is also in like English language films, but like, you know, like these are like mostly Japanese actors, and this, I do feel like this is somewhat of another like missed opportunity for like our friends in the American system who like can't get shit made. You know, like could we have had like two shows set, you know, more like Asian American space? Probably, but you know, those are maybe a little harder to pitch right now. So, I mean, It could have been a lot worse. I'm happy it's not. I'm happy people like it. Happy for all those Asian names getting a fucking paycheck. So I'm not like mad that it exists, but I probably will not be watching the rest of the series, or like I'll be skimming the rest of the series. I'm like, oh, they're dead. They're dead. Dead. Okay, cool. Check.
I will note that what you kind of mentioned is sort of like what Cord Jefferson, who wrote American Fiction, mentioned, which is like, stop throwing like insane amounts of money to the one project and actually split it between several smaller projects that will do that can still do well and have smaller stories.
Yes.
And so I think that would definitely work, because when you think about it, like I'm glad that Sympathizer came from, you know, someone from the diaspora, but it's also still tied greatly to Asia, right? And so I would like to have stories that are based in America, or at least in the diaspora, and not having to be tied back to the motherland in order to be sold as a story that Americans care about, because it's still othering.
Yes, this is still a very, I actually, as good as the performances are, I don't think the portrayal of Japanese people or Japanese society in this show actually moves the needle forward, because I do think it's pretty rooted in like what the Western world thinks of Japan already, like stoic, honor bound. Not much fun to be had there. So, yeah, we'll see. I mean, who knows? It is doing very well, though, I think, in like the general public population. I've only heard good things. So, you know what? It's working, I guess. But in terms of like the show is getting like eyes on it, and like they're getting like in the general public to care. But I'm just like, yeah, like I don't know if like having a bunch of stoic Japanese daimos fighting each other is like moving the empathy needle any bit.
Yeah, and in defense of Sympathizer, half of that story does take place in the United States, so
no absolutely,
we'll get some there at least. But yeah, I thought this was good pop. I enjoyed it way more than I thought I would, because I came in very high on the skepticism meter, and you know, I'm just a sucker for like historical political drama, especially like Warring Kingdom style like politics. I love that stuff. And surprisingly, I found myself pretty endeared with our little idiot captain.
Pilot.
Yeah. Yes. He's so much fun to watch him just be a fish out of water and being so mad about it. And if I get a new like fun insult from him every episode, I'll enjoy as long as he doesn't become like the savior, right? And I think that's kind of, I feel like that's where the story is going. But we'll see what changes they make to the original source material. I mean, I think the original book is very much in the vein of like a Last Samurai, which Hironobu Sanada was in that film too, right?
Yeah, he's been in all of them. I mean, he was even in like Westworld as a samurai.
Yeah. So I want to have faith that this won't become like a white savior type story, that it will kind of just stay like the Marco Polo route, and he's just like a dude just being pulled along in this epic conflict between lords. But I guess we'll see. But I'm actually a little sad that I had to wait a whole week to watch the next episode, because episode 4 does end with some pretty gnarly business. Like we mentioned, the Fail Sons make their move, and there's
death.
Surprising like mass violence happening on screen, which was fun. But yeah, definitely looking forward to continuing on this series. We'll keep you updated, Jess, on the goings-on, if there's anything worth watching later on.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess with that, that'll do it for a discussion of Shogun, playing now on Hulu. And is it also playing on Disney?
Just the Hulu, which is owned by Disney.
Yeah. It's an FX show, so it actually airs on FX in case anyone has cable and cares there. But like the next day, it's on Hulu. So
yeah. Check it out. I guess before we call it an episode, Jess Han, if people want to find out more of your thoughts, where can they go?
I'm on Twitter at JessJuTweets.
And I am still on Twitter and all the other places at Hanonymous.
You can find me on Instagram at Marvin Yue. You can find our show on the internet at goodpop.club. As always, we are a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective. Check out a fellow Asian America hosted podcast by going to the website podcastpotluck.com. And yeah, thanks so much for listening to the Good Pop Culture Club. We'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Marvin.
And I'm Rira.
And we're the hosts of Books and Boba, a book club and podcast dedicated to books by Asian and Asian American authors.
Each month, we pick a book by an Asian author to read and discuss on the show.
We read a variety of genres, including contemporary and historical fiction, sci-fi and fantasy, romance and cozy mysteries, and so much more.
Our past book club picks have included Pachinko by Minjin Lee, Patron Saints of Nothing by Randy Ribeye, Grace of Kings by Ken Liu, and The Kiss Quotient by Helen Huang.
Every month, we also go through the latest news in Asian American literature, as well as chat with some awesome Asian authors about their works.
So whether you want to start reading for fun again or diversify your TBR list, we got your Asian literature cravings covered. For more info, check out our website at booksandboba.com, and you can listen to us on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts.
Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.